But now, for all of us, it's time to reread Heaven Lake. And rereading's kind of an amazing process. Those are the rare books you don't forget that you have to reopen and re-experience all over again. We read quicker, but also richer, surprised at what we remember, loved, and the tension as we see Vincent make mistakes, the way our senses wrap around all the homes and towns that he goes in and through and out, a different and changed person each time. Vincent, in those first dozen pages, has no awareness of his flaws and mistakes and prejudices, and we read about him without judgment or dislike. That's where we see John Dalton, where we see experiences of disagreeable characters and understand Vincent rather than condemn him, when we wait to see what happens with him rather than slap the book closed in frustration. John keeps us reading. Paragraphs and sentences, the unusual characters we meet, such as Trudy, his student lover, the crippled Xiao Fei, Alex, the wandering drug trafficker, Gloria, the calligrapher who loves Jesus a little too much, Mr. Gua, Zhai Ling, and so many others. The flow of John's prose, the smells and sights of Doleo, the eagerness in Vincent we know is doomed. That's why we keep reading. And then we begin to read slower, like we do with all the great novels and picture each scene, each sensation felt by a character's hands, eyes, and ears, as we travel with Vincent through his misguided teaching, his love affair, and north towards Heaven Lake. Now when we talk to our friends, we get a little bit eager, ready to discuss what we loved about the book as we ask, with a little expected lean forward, have you read Heaven Lake yet? Because if you haven't, you will. This novel was awarded the Barnes & Noble 2004 Discovery Award and also received the Sue Kaufman Prize for First Fiction given by the American Academy of Arts and Letters. His short fiction has appeared in Alaska Quarterly Review, Story, and Western Humanities Review. A graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, he's been awarded residencies for the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown, a Hensfield Transatlantic Award, and a James Michener Paul Engel Fellowship. He's taught at Webster University, Washington University, UNC Greensboro, and is now at home with us as an assistant professor at Missouri St. Louis. Please welcome John Dalton.
First, I want to thank Michael Nye. I'm very glad I let you hang out on my patio the other night. That was a very thoughtful and very articulate introduction. I'm very thankful for it. Thank you so much. And I want to thank David Mura for reading before me. I think I can speak for everybody by saying that was absolutely terrific to sit through. And I really, really enjoyed listening to it. And I'm going to dive into the Dumas' latest collection as soon as I get home. So. Thanks also to Richard Newman for inviting me here. I'm gonna read exactly one paragraph from Heaven Lake, and I do it because I feel like I should support the book in some way, even if it's a small way. As many of you may know, it's a book about Vincent Saunders goes to mainland China on the basis of a sham marriage. He's going to marry a woman he doesn't know. And this becomes very complicated. The traveling across China is long and arduous, and the waiting through all the red tape to marry her is long and arduous. And while he's doing all this traveling and waiting, he reads for the very first time in his life, he reads a novel. Before that, he's just been a devotee of the Bible. He's just read the Bible mostly. And so now in order to travel, he selects a big, fat Russian novel. I never say what novel it is, but in my mind, it's Tolstoy's Anna Karenina. And here's one paragraph. The only genuine relief was reading. For several months, he journeyed through the Russian novel at a rate of some 10 pages a day, enough to keep track of the main characters and their ever-widening circle of acquaintances. During the many idle moments of the day, or even in his scattering of languid thoughts before sleep, he might review the story thus far and be struck by the unaccustomed sympathies he felt for the novel's vain or anxiety-prone men, its adulterous or capricious-hearted women, all of whom seemed to be ruled by their own brightly burning temperaments. One afternoon, while balanced on the stair rail outside the telegraph office, he turned the final page. He gazed up from the book, bedazzled, proud. What a substantial jolt of accomplishment to have vanquished the novel's final paragraph, and what a deep and lingering solace to see in the novel's characters the same inner vacillation of intention and worry, the same moment-to-moment uncertainty that he felt almost every second of his waking life. I'm going to read something that is absolutely new. I'm working on a second novel, and this novel is set in rural Missouri, rural southern Missouri in the Ozarks, at a camp called Kittredge Forest Summer Camp. The year is 1975. I'm going to read chapter two, which means I have to tell you about chapter one. In chapter one, the founder and honorary director of the camp, Shula Kittredge, 78 years old, is awake at 2 a.m. and hears laughter in the woods. This pisses him off. He's 78 years old, he's a bachelor, and so he puts his shoes on and he journeys across the camp at night trying to find the source of this laughter. And it seems to be coming from the woods. And when he goes into the woods, he arrives at the camp swimming pool, which is built into the thick of the woods. And there he finds that nearly all of his camp counselors have assembled at 2 a.m. in the morning. And they are, without exception, naked. They're swimming naked. Shuler doesn't have much interest or liking in nudity or sexuality. So this pisses him off even more. And he stands by the gate, and as they run for their clothes and they go running out, he watches and carefully notes exactly who's been down there swimming naked. The next morning, he takes them one at a time to his office and with great relish fires them, tells them that they have lost their job and they have to get out of camp before evening. And so he fires 14 counselors. This is problematic because summer camp is about ready to start in 2 days' time. And so he tells the senior staff members that what they're going to do is they're going to put out phone calls to charity organizations across the Midwest, Chicago, St. Louis, Kansas City, and they're going to reassemble new counselors based on people who are willing on a moment's notice to pack up and work all summer at a summer camp. So he contacts organizations like the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, the YMCA, various Christian organizations. That is chapter one. This is chapter two, and the point of view character is a young man named Wyatt Huddy, and you're going to find out more about him as the chapter unfolds. Chapter two. Very early that morning, with the light slanted and grainy and everything in the depot yard half-shadowed and glimmering with dew, Wyatt raised the blinds and from the window of his cluttered back room saw a red-tailed hawk perched on a wheelbarrow handle, folding and unfolding its russet wings. It swiveled its head about. It blinked its yellow eyes. By no means a rare bird, yet still, for Wyatt, a startling sight. He made a pact with himself to take one course of action should the hawk leap to another perch, and to take the opposite course should it fly away. When neither of these happened, the hawk struck a posture of confounding stillness. He rose and dressed for the day. Then he paced down the hallway and flipped on half the light switches and waited patiently while the long bars of fluorescent lights popped and sputtered and threw their white glare over the center's enormous showroom. Lampshades and scuffed furniture and picture frames and racks of neatly pressed dead men's trousers. It went on forever. Because each item carried some residue, some intimacy from its former owner, Wyatt had to convince himself that it was all ordinary enough to mark and sell or eventually throw away in one of two mammoth dumpsters parked in the depot yard. He'd grown used to tossing out toys, particularly dolls, but sometimes the most inconsequential items could provoke him. A shoelace, for example, made in 1957 and perfectly sealed inside its paper and cellophane wrapper. What modest hopes its maker had had for it, a shoelace. And what a sharp pang of regret to toss it forever unused into the dumpster. Each morning, And this morning was no exception. A caravan of large canvas-sided bins holding yesterday's donations was lined up down the center aisle. Wyatt took a moment to rummage through them. No real treasures, of course. A toaster oven, a glossy white flower vase, a glass certificate frame. To turn such shiny objects over in his hands was to be allowed an elongated view of himself. He didn't linger, but he didn't turn away either, nor was he disgusted or disappointed. Impossible to explain this to others, but it was perfectly all right to go about the center showroom at 6:17 in the morning looking Wyatt-like. He had a magnanimous regard for himself and a luxurious sense of time. For nearly 2 hours, he would have sole use of the employee washroom and kitchen. He'd make breakfast and then begin sorting the bins. At 8, Mrs. Barnett would come in and help him with the pricing. They'd work until the clerks, Mindy and Janet, arrived and counted up their cash drawers. By then, a few bargain hunters might be waiting outside the sliding glass door, which was fine if they were regular customers or friends of Mrs. Barnett. He would stay where he was and keep on with the pricing and shelving. But if they were strangers, especially mothers with small children, then the easiest and most pleasurable part of his workday was over, and he would hurry back to the loading dock where, for the remainder of the morning and afternoon and early evening, he would unload and repair whatever heavy furniture the trucks brought in. It was taxing and sometimes hazardous work, which was why he felt such contentment now to sit in the employee kitchen with his cereal and waffles hot from the toaster and read a magazine, a bygone issue of Popular Mechanics. This morning's article, Build Your Own Watercraft of the Future. The design was certainly handsome, though the assembly instructions thwarted him at every turn. When he glanced up, bands of bright sunlight had begun pouring through the windows. Minutes later, he heard a steady thump-thump clink, thump-thump clink, that couldn't have been the ventilation or any of the center's innumerable objects settling on the shelf. He stood and cocked an ear toward each corner of the showroom. Then he made his way down the center aisle and out the back door to the loading dock. And there was Captain Throckmorton, trudging away atop a rickety treadmill that the donation trucks had brought in the day before. A crown of sweat had beaded around the captain's bald head. Every few seconds, a drop would plunge down his cheek or the back of his neck. He seemed not to know what to do with his arms, and finally, to keep them from bouncing at his sides, he rested them on the shelf of his belly, a high-set, comically round, pregnant woman's belly. From time to time, he glanced at Wyatt and rolled his eyes as if to say, "I know I am absurd. I know I'm a spectacle." Perhaps others might have thought so. Not Wyatt, who a few years earlier had been rescued by Captain Throckmorton from a steadily worsening family situation. If there was anything truly unusual about the captain, it was that unlike other Salvation Army captains or other men who worked at the center, he didn't appear to have stumbled shaken and pale and weak out of a ruinous past life. He lived across the street and shared an apartment with his best friend, the barber Ed McClintock. They both sang tenor in the St. James Choir. They went trout fishing every spring. Each Wednesday evening, they invited Wyatt to their apartment for dinner and board games. Just before they began their game, usually Risk or Yahtzee, Ed McClintock made coffee and poured a single shot glass of Irish cream into his and the captain's cup. This would be the only alcohol they'd consume all evening, perhaps all week. And before raising the cup for his first sip, Ed McClintock would say, "Here's to our glamorous lives, Captain." In time, Captain Throckmorton slowed his pace and stepped off the treadmill. He consulted a stopwatch hanging from his neck. For a while, he did nothing but breathe deeply. 11 minutes, he said. "And you mean to tell me people torture themselves on these things for an hour a day?" Wyatt said that yes, he thought they did. "Hard to believe," Captain Throckmorton said. He studied the treadmill as if it had reneged on an extravagant promise. Then he produced a handkerchief and wiped sweat from his brow and chin. How'd the watch go last night, Wyatt? Fine. I take it our crime-free streak remains alive? Wyatt couldn't help but grin. It was a joke he'd come to enjoy, that the captain paid him to watch over the depot yard and showroom at night rather than unload donation trucks during the day. That was part of the joke. The other part, which he'd not quite understood at first, was that few, if any, thieves would be interested in secondhand furniture and clothing in a Salvation Army depot on the outskirts of Jefferson City, Missouri. Nothing stolen, Wyatt reported. But I wanted to ask. Yes. Wyatt crossed and uncrossed his arms and looked out over the depot yard to the wheelbarrow handle and saw that the red-tailed hawk, his bird of decision, had taken flight. Is it a rule, do you think, that everyone has to swim? Everyone who works at a summer camp? I wouldn't think so, because it seems like it would be a rule. Every time you see a show about summer camp on TV, people are always swimming. I'm sure it's not a rule. I'm sure there are counselors who don't swim at all. All right, then. I've changed my mind about working at summer camp. It was rare to see Captain Throckmorton taken by surprise. There was a sharp focus to his gaze. His coloring deepened into something like a blush. You have, he said. I'm very glad to hear that, Wyatt. Very glad. It would have been a mistake, I think, to waste another summer here. Yes, maybe so. I'll call Mr. Kittredge right now, and I'll have one of the ladies from the St. James Auxiliary drive you down. He smiled hugely. This is good news, he said. You've changed your mind. Was it about swimming all along? It's always awkward, isn't it, when you have to go someplace and settle in and introduce yourself 100 times? I suppose so. Especially for me, Wyatt said. Plus, I've never tried working with children. Once his word had been given, it couldn't be taken back. He knew that. He packed his clothes and towels and soaps and the retainer he wore at night and a 4-in-1 abridged Reader's Digest book he didn't much enjoy reading. Mrs. Barnett brought him a flashlight and canteen she'd gathered from the store shelves. She told him to spray for insects and not to stand in direct sunshine. The clerks, Mindy and Janet, who rarely talked to him, stood unseen in the hallway outside his room and called out together in the same tepid voice, "Have a good summer, Wyatt." Captain Throckmorton hurried to Sears and bought a new sleeping bag. He said, "Choose a cabin bed near a window." He said, "If you get a cold or sunburn or nosebleed, go straight to the nurse." He said, "A good way to begin a conversation is to say, 'Excuse me, I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Wyatt Huddy.'" By now, the center, which had been entirely and exquisitely Wyatt's at 6 a.m., was alive with the clamor of phones and earnest customers. Both Mrs. Barnett and Captain Throckmorton had matters to attend to. Their goodbyes were rushed and clumsy. "Take care and be careful." The truck drivers, hard-pressed and often bitter older men, considered Wyatt's leaving a desertion. "Why summer camp?" they asked. "What's the point when there are upright freezers and heavy office desks to unload?" Wyatt couldn't think of a reasonable answer, and to escape their sourness, he waited out back beside the gravel lane that led from Highway 54 up to the loading dock. 10 minutes later, a white Ford Galaxy turned into the lane and made a slow, rather halting progression toward the depot building. It rolled past him. It braked. It backed up. "Excuse me," a voice called from the driver's window. "I'm looking for Captain Throckmorton." "He's in his office," Wyatt said. "But are you from St. James?" The driver, a middle-aged woman in a sleeveless checkered blouse, had climbed from the car and was rounding its front end. "I've been assigned a job," she said, "and I was wonder..." She stopped in her tracks. "I'm Wyatt Huddy," he said. She noticed his duffel bag and turned the whole of her attention toward it. All the features of her ruddy face were pinched in concentration. She furrowed her brow. She grimaced. After a while, she said, "The back driveway to the depot, it's not very well known," he offered. "Marked," she said, still scrutinizing his duffel bag. "I passed the signpost a few times before I saw it, and then, I don't know." "Then you found it?" "Yes, I'm Barbara McCauley from the St. James Auxiliary. Thank you for driving me." "Oh," she said and waved her hand to and fro. "It's not any, but it is. It's a long way there and back. Would you like me to ride in the back seat, Barbara?" She appeared to consider the offer, tilted her head in thought, reached a conclusion. "Up front is fine," she said. Yet once they'd buckled themselves in and set out, she seemed unnerved by his close proximity. She gripped the wheel and fixed her gaze on the road ahead. What he felt for her then, what he always felt in these strange circumstances, was a tenderness so acute it nearly pierced his heart. Who better than he to understand her discomfort, her embarrassment? He was, after all, well acquainted with the many flavors of distress people felt upon first seeing him. In Barbara McCauley's case, it wouldn't improve matters to explain that the displacement of his features, the left half of his face higher than the right, the eyes offset by nearly an inch, the nose a bit mashed, the right side of his mouth sloping down, had a name, and that in most cases it portended severe mental retardation, though luckily or unluckily, not so for him. He wasn't retarded, a fact to be carefully and painfully imparted to every stranger he met, not disabled, not handicapped, but not the equal of other young men or women his age either. He'd earned a high school equivalency diploma from a technical school. He could assist in the repair of lawnmowers and certain automobiles, and might have gone further in his career were it not for the machine manuals, which proved either too difficult or too poorly written. But he could weld. He had a good memory. In the 2.5 years he'd lived in the depot, Captain Throckmorton had taught him to keep track of stock and answer phones, and in conversation, to not only reply to a question with a complete thought, but to use your conversation partner's name whenever possible. They rode with the windows down to the outskirts of Jefferson City. Once the highway traffic opened up, Barbara McCauley let one hand drop from the wheel and braved a glance in his direction. "I bet you're an athlete," she said. "I bet you play football. Does the Salvation Army have sports teams?" "No, not teams, not ones that travel to other places. But you've played some football, haven't you?" "Not really. We play field hockey on the dock sometimes, me and the other loaders." "Oh, but you should talk to the other boys you work with and get them all together for a football match. You'd be great at it, a young man your size. You'd smash right on through and score a goal." "Thank you, Barbara. I'll think about doing that." She turned her attention back to the highway, which was arrow straight and sided by long-drawn fields of soybean and corn. Under the sun's hard glare, everything, the fields, the farm silos, the gravel roads, seemed haloed by bands of wavering heat. Wyatt closed his eyes and pretended to doze. He might have slept for a spell. When he sat up again, he found that the landscape had changed from cropland to a range of gentle, small, shrub-covered hills. They stopped at a drive-in for lunch, and Barbara McCauley bought him, over his objection, 2 king-size hamburgers. She sipped a coffee and told him that several years back, when her son and friends had played high school football, they would practice at a nearby park and then tramp right into her kitchen looking for food. She made them remove their jerseys and pads before serving them hamburgers. But what a mess and commotion they made, these sweaty, shirtless teenage boys gathered around her kitchen table. She said she wanted to spank their butts and send them straight to the shower. It seemed to cheer her, this story, and once they'd climbed back into the galaxy, she had lively opinions to share on a number of topics. For instance, the Lawrence Welk singers and dancers, who could teach young people a lot about how to behave, and a hooded sweatshirt she mail-ordered and was waiting to arrive. And finally, and at great length, she talked about a Shetland pony she owned that was more perceptive about her moods than her husband or children or, for that matter, any person she'd ever met. By then, she was urging the car up one steep and winding incline after another, only to let it drop down the opposite side. It was, for Wyatt, an unfamiliar terrain, not just steep hills, but small mountains, eroded and ancient-looking, and separated by craggy valleys, nearly all of which contained deep hollows or clear, gurgling creeks. Each ridge and valley seemed to have a peculiar name, the Devil's Backbone, Sweet Molly's Gap. Kittredge Forest was set back 3 miles from the highway along a well-tended gravel road, its entrance gate fronted by a bench made of split logs, rickety and tarnished. Beyond the gate stood a weathered office and cottage, nothing particularly welcoming or celebratory about either of these buildings. The same was true of the campgrounds, which, like the countryside in general, looked ancient and weedy. In Wyatt's view, it was not how a summer camp should be. And yet, beyond question, it was more beautiful than anything he'd anticipated, more striking and vast and real, with stone fences and a giant meadow that shone lushly green beneath the bright midday sun. The trees were either knotted hickories or tall bristling pines. Through a curtain of such trees, he could see several hulking cedar cabbages, gray and aged with weather. When he turned to thank Barbara McCauley and climb from the car, he found her ruddy-faced, squeezed with emotion. "Don't you dare thank me," she insisted. "This drive, this time we've spent together, Wyatt, has been a great opportunity for me. It's really made me think." She looked, for the time being, too overwhelmed to report on whatever conclusions she might have reached. She dropped him off with his duffel bag at the mess hall steps and sped away. Inside the mess hall, a meeting was underway. To attend, he must pass through screen doors and take his place among a gathering of what could only be other newly arrived counselors. This, more than the swimming, was the dread he had tried to describe to Captain Throckmorton. But perhaps it couldn't be described. Perhaps it was Wyatt's burden to own each second of what happened next. The slow creak of the screen door opening, the clap of it swinging shut, more than a dozen strangers turning their bright faces toward him, their gaze expectant, then startled, then troubled. And then, of course, the moment of recognition, the sizing up and the swift classification, maybe too swift. Had Captain Throckmorton called ahead? Had they been told in advance? Because they seemed to recognize him, or at least expect his arrival. A heavy-set, middle-aged woman led the meeting. She gave Wyatt her name without any indication of what her position might be, Linda Palamo. She rifled through a clipboard of papers and, with a satisfied grunt of relief, seemed to find the proper notation. "Wyatt Huddy?" she asked. To this, Wyatt nodded. He felt keenly the purposeful way each person in the room turned their attention elsewhere. "We've put you in cabin 4. "Yes, all right. And in a moment, you'll have a list of your campers." She regarded him frankly. "Are we set then?" "Yes," he said, "all set." He found a bench at the rear of the hall. A paper was making its way toward him. When it arrived, he found his own name and beneath it a list of campers, 5 names long. "I was explaining to the group, Wyatt, that at the end of the day, after the evening activity, you'll escort your campers back to the cabins. You'll make sure they wash up. You'll see that they brush their teeth and get to bed. After that, you'll be off duty and can gather in the common room with the other counselors. We expect you to be back in your cabins and asleep by midnight. Am I clear about that?" The new counselors gave her a mild nod, which seemed enough for Linda Palamo. She then explained meal procedures and nightly cabin watch duty. While she spoke, she flipped through her clipboard of papers. "Never mind," she said. "Never mind. It's too much to tell you all at once. I'm afraid you'll have to learn as you go along. The scheduling, for example. It's always..." She stopped herself. From outside came the bray of a diesel engine. A large white bus, the first of 3, appeared at the far end of the meadow and rumbled toward the mess hall. Linda Palamo squeezed shut her eyes a moment, concentrated. "For now, I'm going to insist that you remember one thing. After each meal, you will walk your campers next door to the infirmary and present them to our nurse, Harriet Foster. You will identify each camper for Harriet. If they require medications, you will make sure they take them. You will do this for every meal, breakfast, lunch, dinner, The buses had drawn close, veered from the gravel lane, and rolled to a halt a few yards deep in the meadow. One by one, they shut down their squalling engines. In each vehicle, a mob of passengers rose from their seats and thronged the aisle. The first bus threw open its door, and down climbed a truly odd-looking teacher or chaperone, an absurdly pear-shaped woman, a great ridge of fat around her waist, but a thin chest and arms and wide, flapping, probably toothless mouth. Wyatt, who never failed to notice such irregularities, stared. What scorn she must receive from the children. Behind her was another curiosity, a very tall, lanky gentleman with a sloping forehead who limped down the bus's landing and took a few unsteady steps across the meadow. And after him came a squat little man who wore impossibly thick glasses and whose wide eyes and myopic gaze and pursed lips were all clear markings of mental retardation, of an affliction, Down syndrome, which Wyatt happened to know by name. Within the mess hall, the new counselors began to stir and shift, and all at once, amid their anxious muttering, "They're here already, they're here," and Linda Palamo's exhortations to remain calm, they rose clutching their bags and hurried from the mess hall down the pathways toward the cabins. Wyatt stayed behind, and when the opportunity presented itself, he approached Linda Palamo and broached his question. "Will there be children?" he asked. "Is it a camp for children?" There was a clear wrinkling of concern in her otherwise patient regard. All the while she held his gaze. "It is a camp for children, Wyatt, but not the first two sessions," Linda explained. "For the first two sessions, all the campers will be handicapped adults from the state hospital or from private homes." He could not, for the time being, sort out exactly what this meant, but the explanation itself, the hesitancy with which it had been delivered, caused a deep crimson blush to color his face. "Are you all right?" Linda Palamo asked. "I am, yes, I'm fine," he said and hoisted his bag. "Thank you, Captain Palamo," he said and pushed through the mess hall doors. Outside, huge white bundles of laundry were tumbling out the rear hatch of each bus, a peculiar sight like doughy eggs spilling from the ends of mammoth caterpillars. More campers had stepped down and were padding dazed and incredulous atop the thick carpet of grass. The lanky gentleman with a sloping forehead flapped his arms. A woman swiveled her jowly head back and forth and squealed in terror or delight. Wyatt, his duffel bag bouncing atop one shoulder, gaped at them as he trailed behind the other counselors, down a hillside, and then along a series of winding gravel pathways. It was a different landscape entirely once they left the clearing and moved across the forest floor, all pine needles and embedded rock, and came upon the first of several gray cedar cabins. But which cabin number was his? 4, he hoped, because he was already trudging up cabin 4's entrance ramp. Inside, he found an interior porch, a long toilet and shower room, counselor's quarters, all 3 beds of which had been claimed. The left and right wings of the cabin were comprised of 2 large barrack-like dorm rooms. He dumped his bag on the first window-side bed on the right. No time, really, to take stock of his accommodations or negotiate introductions with the other male counselors hurrying past him out the door. What else could he do but race after them? By the time they reached the buses, the meadow was brimming with adult campers, a many-numbered congregation of hard limbs and twisted arms and legs and sunken feet and sunken features, so many oddities that soon it was the odd and the ugly that became the norm, and the balanced walk, the faultless body, the unspoiled face that drew attention. Thank you.